certification are available. Learn to care for others. Curious? Learn more at AADSC.org. That's AADSC.org. This message brought to you by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Earth, sky.
Scientists have been able to store and successfully recall data from a strand of synthetic DNA.
They stored an audio recording of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, plus Shakespeare's sonnets and more. They were able to translate, store, and retrieve this data. These scientists say it might be possible to store a billion books worth of data for thousands of years in a single small test tube. They published this result in the journal Nature in early 2013.
Storing information is what DNA does best. DNA holds our genetic code and spells out the exact genetic instructions required to create a particular organism. The researchers at the European Bioinformatics Institute commented that scientists now know how to extract DNA from bones of woolly mammoths. That DNA dates back tens of thousands of years, but still, they can make sense of it. They mentioned that DNA is incredibly small, dense, and doesn't need any power for storage.
Previous attempts at encoding data onto DNA failed because those methods tried to translate a computer's binary data directly onto the DNA. They said binary repetition caused errors in retrieval.
This time, they succeeded by translating the binary information into ternary information. In other words, it uses 0, 1, and 2, and then encoding that into the DNA. We have more on this story at earthsky.org. Search for DNA. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Are you on a doubtful career path? The Southern Southeast Alaska Technical Education Center is offering the Safe and Competent Worker Series to begin on February 11th at the C-Tech building on 615 Stedman Street. This seven-week series includes multiple industry standard certificates such as first aid, CPR, AED, HAZWOPER, OSHA training, and more. To apply, stop by C-Tech or call Pete Jensen at 228-9294.
Support is provided by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping reach educational savings goals. Save in Alaska. Save anywhere. Information at 1-888-4-ALASKA.
And now we're joined by Anne Freshley and Lacely Simpson for the Museums Report. How are you doing, guys?
Good, thanks.
Good morning.
So what do you got for us today?
Oh, we have lots of things going on at the Museum Department. Currently on display at the Tongass Historical Museum, we have a great exhibit titled New England Fish Co., a 1930 photo album. We've had this on display since early January, and we have just a few more weeks left if you haven't had a chance to check it out. But it's a really fabulous display of 1930-era images that were put together by Emery Tobin, who worked for the New England Fish Company, which was a pretty major fish processing plant. They had a cannery and also a freezing facility. And they were in high swing around 1930. And this great photo album that came into the museum's possession, we've replicated the pages from the photo album, and that's what's on display in the museum. And it's just a great snapshot of what life was like, you know, during that time in Ketchikan, the technologies of the time for the cannery and also the freezing facility, and some of the people who were involved with the cannery and what daily life was like for them. So it's really great photo album. There's just a lot to look at. And included with those images from the photo album are actually typed captions by Emery Tobin, the bookkeeper who put together this marketing photo album. So you get a sense of, you know, what the company is trying to portray, you know, what it is that they're really trying to get to the heart of with those images. You know, they're really proud of, again, the technology that they have at the time, which was, you know, state of the art, you know, the types of canning equipment that they had and freezing equipment, and how, you know, their fish traps that they created, how strong and efficient they were. So really fabulous captions to read through as well with those great.
I think you may have answered the question I had.
Where
did the images come from? They came from a collection then?
Yes. So they actually came to the museum department in 1970s. I'm not sure the exact date. They were donated to us. And so Emery Tobin, who was the bookkeeper at that point in time, Emery Tobin later went on to found the Alaska Sportsman magazine, which was in operation for a very long time, which is now Alaska Magazine. So still in existence, but a slightly different magazine. But he was the bookkeeper for the New England Fish Company, and he was tasked with creating this marketing photo album to showcase and highlight, you know, the superiority, I suppose, of the New England Fish Company versus some of the other canneries of the time in this particular location. And it's over 100 pages long. We did not make replicas of every single page, but a good deal of them are on display. So.
Very cool. How long is that on display for?
That is up until February 23rd, so just a few more weeks. So if you haven't had a chance to check it out, I really recommend doing so. It's been a lot of fun having it on display. We've had people come in of all different generations and say, oh, you know, my dad worked there, or I had my first summer job at the cannery. And so it has a personal place in people's hearts, I think, in the community, because, you know, it really was such a fixture in our community for a very, very long time.
Right.
So it's exciting to hear some of those stories of people who come to visit and share their own you know, relationship that they had with the cannery. Yeah, so that's on display until February 23rd. The museum has their winter operating hours for the gallery right now. If you'd like to check out the exhibit, the museum is open Tuesday through Friday from 1 to 5 and Saturdays from 10 to 4. And, of course, admission is free and open this time of year to the public. So come on down. And then we actually have a very fun program starting this Saturday in conjunction with the exhibit. We have a fun day at the Tongass Historical Museum.
Yeah, we've been working hard putting together a great group of different little programs and activities that are for it's free, open to the public. Families with children, you're welcome to show up. We appreciate when parents accompany your little ones. Just you get more out of it too. It could be a great family activity, something to do together. But of course, focusing or sort of drawing from that New England Fish Co. Exhibit, we're sort of adapting and focusing definitely on salmon and fish. We'll have a fun kind of fishing pond, not with real fish, of course, but you'll have the chance to catch as many fish as you can, learn a little bit about identifying the species, and then to kind of complete the circle and the experience of maybe a little bit of what it's like to work in the fishing industry, you're going to sell your catch. So you're going to have to do a little bit of math there and see if you can top the charts for your brief number of minutes fishing season. See how you
can
do. Your
opener.
Yeah, your opener. You got to get as many as you can. So that should be real fun. We're looking forward to kids getting a chance to experience the fishing season in a miniature form. We've got some craft activities. You can make yourself a Chinook salmon hat. And we've got also the salmon ladder game. So kind of an adaptation of chutes and ladders that allows you to sort of experience what it's like to be a hungry growing salmon, the challenges and also some of the benefits. Some good delicious krill might move you up a little bit. So should be a blast. We welcome you to come. This is going to be, again, this coming Saturday from 10 a.m. till noon. So you have 2 hours. Should be enough time for you to try as many of those activities. You can come at any point during that time and just dive in to enjoying some of those fun activities and crafts. And we hope to see you there. Again, it's free, open to the public. Kids of all ages should be able to get a kick out of experiencing salmon fishing.
I might be showing my Ketchikan newbiness here, but people make salmon hats.
it's not out of real fish.
Okay, that's what I was curious about.
It's a paper craft, but really, really fun. Okay. So, yeah. Yep. So that, again, you know, coming up this Saturday, don't want to miss out. They're free and open to the public from 10 to noon. And then the other thing that we have going on at the Historical Museum happening in the coming weeks is we will be hosting a special traveling exhibit on the 100th year anniversary of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood. We're really excited to have this come to town. The Ketchikan Camp 14 of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood, as well as the Saxman Camp 15, are helping us sponsor this event to bring this exhibit to town. The Alaska Native Brotherhood just this past year celebrated, and Sisterhood, celebrated their 100th year. And there was a big to-do in Sitka with their Grand Camp celebration. And part of that celebration was to create these permanent display panels that showcase the history of the Brotherhood and Sisterhood in Alaska, mostly its earlier years. And those panels that were created are now permanently on display at the Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall in Sitka. But they created a traveling version that will now go around the state. And we'll be hosting it here in Ketchikan at the Tongass Historical Museum beginning Tuesday, February 19th. We'll be having an opening reception from 5 to 7 p.m. And again, that's free and open to anyone who'd like to attend. And we'll have those panels on display for about a week until through Saturday, February 23rd. And then after we've had them on display, they will go to the Saxman Community Hall starting Sunday, February 24th, and they will be on display and through the 27th, and then they will actually go back to Sitka and then on to further locations. But they're really beautiful panels. They're freestanding, they're double-sided, and they have just very rich history, a lot of photographs and, you know, facts, who some of those earlier people were in both the Brotherhood and Sisterhood that really got the civil rights movement going in Alaska for Native rights, and how, you know, what some of the issues were that they were tackling, you know, what the different adversities they had to overcome to make those successes happen. So we're really excited to have this.
It's also kind of an interesting and, I find, amazing fact that the ANB and ANS are the oldest indigenous civil rights organization, and that happened in Alaska, one of the younger states. It's a remarkable story, and they've done a beautiful job. Of course, it's a topic that could probably be, I don't know, volumes of information, but they've done the best they can with the help of the AMB and ANS, particularly in Sitka, to really be as inclusive and as they possibly can in that amount of format. But so it's a great deal of information and very well done. So definitely take the opportunity to stop in and view those at either of their locations during their stay in Ketchikan. It's definitely worth being part of that 100-year celebration.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal. Like Ann said, we weren't even actually a state when we had Native civil rights,
right,
which was pretty
amazing. Was this meant to coincide with Elizabeth Paratovich Day, or is that just a coincidence?
Elizabeth Paratovich Day is something that's celebrated every year, and she was certainly a huge, you know, person that was involved with civil rights and the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood. But the panels were, and the traveling exhibit really do coincide with that 100th year anniversary of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. So, yeah, after the big celebration in Sitka just this past year, then those panels are now moving throughout the state so that, you know, lots of different camps around the state can have the opportunity to celebrate that 100th year. So, yeah. And then over, I know that we're just giving you lots of information.
A couple more minutes.
Yeah, but as always, you know, you can give us a call at 225-5900 if you'd like more information. You can visit us at ketchikanmuseums.org, or if you're a Facebook person, we've got lots of information on Facebook for either facility. But we do have some things going on at the Totem Heritage Center.
We've got the spring season of classes are gearing up and actually coming up pretty quickly here. We're starting off with a carving class. It's intermediate level, Northwest Coast carving, and your project will be ladles. And we are proud to have guest instructor Tommy Joseph coming to us from Sitka. It's a Sitka invasion, but he's a fantastic artist. He has his own gallery in Sitka now, but great opportunity to learn from somebody coming to town. That is going to start up very quickly here. This is from February 11th through 19th. It's a pretty condensed class, but it's the full 30 hours to work on that project. And it is not too late. We will make room for you to sign up for that class. So if you're a last-minute person and holy moly, this is your reminder, give us a call. We'll still get you in there. And luckily for you, if you are in that boat, materials are included in this class. Your ALDER will be included in your class fee. So please give us a call if you're still interested in jumping in on that class to start off the spring season. And so the button robes was to follow.
Yes, we were actually going to be hosting an advanced regalia class focusing on button robes. That was to start on February 18th. But it looks like due to low enrollment, we'll be canceling that class for the time being. If we change information about that, we'll certainly let everybody know. But we'll be contacting students to let them know that we'll be canceling that button robe class for the time being. So we're very sorry about that. But as always, we need sufficient enrollment to make classes happen. But also coming up, it seems a little early, but it's really not. We want to let people know that we'll be hosting our annual Spring Break Cedar Bark Weaving class for youth with Holly Churchill, and that takes place over the school district spring break. This has been a wonderfully successful and popular class. So that starts March 18th and goes through the 22nd. So it's something to start thinking about if you're a parent, or perhaps if you are a school-age student who happens to be listening right now, something to think about. Tell your parents to help get you registered, because we do typically run out of room in that class, which is great that there's such a demand for it. But early registration is the key, absolutely. And it's a lot of fun. Holly Churchill is a dynamite instructor with all ages, and she really does actually have quite
absolutely.
A gift with youth. And we'll walk young weavers through the whole weaving process so that they walk away after that week with a completed project. It's pretty cool. And there's a lot of students who come back year after year and take on more advanced and complicated projects. And it's very exciting for us to see, hopefully, the next little generation of weavers coming up through the ranks. So that's what's coming up. If you'd like to register for any of the classes that we mentioned, we actually have even more classes coming up, but they're a little bit further down the line. So
we'll be back to remind you.
Yeah. Sure. But information on all of our classes, again, is online, or you can give us a call if you'd like specific dates and those sorts of things if you missed it. So our number is 225-5900, or go to ketchikanmuseums.org or Facebook.
Excellent. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
And Freshly and Lacey Simpson with the Museums Report. The time now is 8:35. You're listening to KRBD Ketchikan. And now we're joined by phone with Alan Bailey from the Ketchikan Gateway Borough Assembly. How are you doing, Mr. Bailey?
Good morning to you. Very well.
So there was a Borough Assembly meeting last night, and it looks like it was a pretty eventful meeting. It was pretty busy. Could you walk us through some of the highlights of the meeting?
I will. Actually, for most of our meetings, this was, again, a pretty light meeting, but we did have some very good discussions. And we had some citizen comments come forward. Mayor Kiefer was provided with a recognition proclamation for his service of the historic Ketchikan, and that was well received and appreciated. Dan Ortiz thanked us for the assembly for the activities funding for the school district that was provided last year, and that was $200,000. And then he said that certainly provided assistance for his two programs that he had. And then one person stepped forward to support the federal funding request for the Ketchikan Medical Center. With our agenda specifically, there's an introduction of an ordinance 1650 that amended the code title of 18, or particular chapters of it, which has to do with detached accessory dwelling units and deleting the one-story height limit, adding a provision that allows for planning commission to alter maximum gross floor area. The person wanted to add it up. An apartment over the garage, they can now do it. So I was pleased to that we were able to approve that, and it is for a hearing, a public hearing, for the 25th. So if anybody has comments about that, please come forward, and that would be helpful as well. But the one that gives the individual owners rights to their own property, and this one individual just simply wanted to build an apartment over his garage, and with the current code, that they weren't able to do that. So hopefully, if this prevails, then he'll be able to do that.
Why is there a restriction in the first place? What was the thought behind it?
I wish I could tell you. I can't. There are half of these ordinances or regulations. You got to scratch your head and wonder, well, where did that come from? And I'm sure it's originally from some measure to try to control either height of buildings so as not to interfere with other views of other individuals. There's probably an array of reasons why, but I couldn't tell you specifically why that was put into that code or ordinances. That was before my time.
And now the ordinance is supposed to allow people to be more flexible in what they do with their DADs, correct?
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. We had a Board of Education report. Superintendent Boyle did make some preliminary comments. There is concern with regards to the initial discussion with regards to the $7.7 million that was being discussed as part of the budget coming forth, and that is certainly short from where they were at last year. Part of the issue that's really significant that the borough is going to be struggling with is we have had a $2 million shortfall from rural schools funding that was being provided, and that no longer exists. So, however, rather than passing on the entire $2 million loss, there was some discussion in our policy meeting that schools should only incur $500,000 of that $2 million loss. Still, that is substantial, no question about it, and it is serious, and it is things that we have to find a way to work through to help support our schools. So we have a lot of discussion yet to go, and I hope that we'll be able to all collectively figure out how we could best serve our students. So,
yeah. Has there been any discussion yet on what sorts of things might have to be cut in the event of $500,000 loss to the schools?
Well, again, this is so preliminary, and then you're aware that the school board is the one that makes those kinds of decisions, in concert with the superintendent. I mean, they make those decisions, but however, it's all based on funding. So, you know, they're talking maintenance, they're talking, you know, some of the preschool kinds of programs that are provided. it's not good. If you read the papers in Anchorage, you'll see it's even worse up there.
Mm-hmm.
So all that to say is this is preliminary discussions. We have a ways to go, and we need to do what's right by our kids. So I'm hoping that, and the public. So it's a balancing act. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope we'll be able to figure this one out. Continuing, let's see. There was resolution both 2458 and 2459 that's authorizing submission of an Alaska Clean Water Actions Grant application to develop local education services, and it addresses proper operation and maintenance of on-site septic systems. Ketchikan has over, I think it's around over 1,000, or maybe it's a substantial number of on-site septic systems.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout our island, which is not common to all other areas. And so there's this DEC thing where, you know, there has to be Clean Water Acts and all that kind of stuff. And it's going to become extraordinarily complicated. But it's something that we should be doing all along anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So and we're going to learn more about this as time goes on, but for those who have on site septic systems, there are some requirements for maintaining the systems, making sure that they're properly functioning and that you don't have wastewater going to your neighbor's property or out into the ocean. You know, that's not approved, or it's not something that should be going out on somebody else's property.
Right. Now, the intention of this is to make sure that people's septic systems don't pollute other people's drinking water or the waters around Ketchikan.
Sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's also the 2459 also is the addition for the Forest Park area, Shute Street area to Forest Park extension for the septic system out there. So that has been going on for about 14 years now, and so they're submitting the questionnaires for that addition as well. The liquor license was approved. Resolutions authorizing the submissions of the, which was a big deal, $20 million for the Ketchikan Medical Center was adopted.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually, I wanted to ask you about that. I know Congress has banned earmarks, but yet the Alaska Congressional Delegation has asked communities to submit funding needs for priority projects. How does that play out exactly? How is that working?
Well, I think, you know, it was requested last year. It was not received, but it's not going to stop us from continuing to request. Our hospital is critical to our area, is to Southeast Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So I know when we met with our delegation last year, I know there was expressed interest, and you either have the votes or you don't.
Right.
But
right.
Bottom line is this is going to make a lot of difference for our community, and it's necessary and needed. This isn't something like, we want two or three bridges across the channel. We want this medical facility to be able to compete and be able to serve our community in Southeast Alaska, and it's critical and important. Not everybody can fly down to Seattle every time they get a cold.
That is true.
So it's pretty important. So once again, we'll meet with the delegation in March, and we'll try to be persuasive once again to, and this is in support of the city's request for this amount of money. And that basically concludes the meeting last night.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I forgot to ask you, with the liquor license, that's for Last Frontier?
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the assembly members' establishments, so he was basically set aside, and we put it on based on its merit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been no problems, no complaints, and so this was not difficult.
And I'm sure he was very happy with the result.
Well, he appreciated I mean, it was an appropriate vote, and it was all above board, so as it should be.
Excellent. Was there anything else that we missed before I let you go?
Let's see. We're going to we approved through the manager's report. It was a four-hand support for Assembly members Thompson and Moran to travel to Juneau to participate in these meetings. That is very critical. And these two are very articulate in their debate. So I think we got two good people to step forward of the Assembly. And this has to do with educational funding, mm-hmm. and that is critical for all of us. So we hope that they, too, will prevail and be able to provide the sufficient arguments that we can become properly funded for our education programs throughout Alaska, but certainly Ketchikan.
Definitely. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Bailey. I appreciate it.
Okay, and you have a very good day.
You too. That was Alan Bailey with the Ketchikan Gateway Borough Assembly. The time now is 8:48. You're listening to KRBD Ketchikan.
Support for KRBD is provided by Timber and Marine Supply, featuring Evinrude, Honda, and Suzuki outboards, Easy Loader boat trailers, and Lund aluminum boats. Timber and Marine Supply, 225-6644, located next to Madison Lumber and Hardware on Tongass Avenue.
Support for KRBD comes from GCI Video, providing video on demand that includes access to movies, documentaries, special events, and original series. GCI, connecting Southeast Alaskans for 30 years.
Support for KRBD comes from BP. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 5th of February, 2013. It's the birthday of the cartoonist John Callahan, born in Portland, Oregon, 1951. He was adopted as an infant from an orphanage in Portland. Educated in Catholic schools, he was a rebellious kid. When he was 12, he stole a bottle of gin during his grandmother's wake and became a serious alcoholic as a teenager. When he was 21, he got drunk and accepted a ride from a drunk friend who crashed the car into a telephone pole at 90 miles an hour. Callahan's spine was severed and he became a quadriplegic. That was in 1972. 6 years later, he said, "I knew with utter certainty that my problem was not quadriplegia, it was alcoholism." So he went to AA, he got sober, went back to school, Portland State, realized he had a talent for cartooning. And by the mid-1980s, he was nationally syndicated, a very controversial cartoonist. His targets included disabled people, politically incorrect, and many readers did not realize that Callahan himself was a quadriplegic. He drew a cartoon in which a sheriff's posse is standing around an empty wheelchair, and the caption, "Don't worry, he won't get far on foot." He drew an exercise class for quadriplegics, the aerobics instructor saying, "Okay, let's get those eyeballs moving." He did a cartoon entitled AA in LA, a man standing up and saying, "My name is Mort, and I represent Chuck, who's an alcoholic." Callahan published two autobiographies, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot, and Will the Real John Callahan Please Stand Up, died at the age of 59 from complications related to quadriplegia and respiratory problems. John Callahan, who said, "I'm happiest when I'm offensive. I have a desire to tear people in half. I want to move people out of the suburbs of their mind. I want them to suffer, to feel something real. I have a lot of anger. I want to hurt people, at least a little." It's the birthday of the actor and director-screenwriter Christopher Guest, born New York City, 1948, wrote musical parodies for the cast of National Lampoon. 1984 starred in a movie, This Is Spinal Tap, which got mediocre reviews when it came out, but went on to have a huge following. And from then on, Christopher Guest used the model that had worked so well for This Is Spinal Tap, a bare-bones screenplay that let the actors improvise their dialogue. And he directed Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, and For Your Consideration. Christopher Guest, who said, "It's obviously inherently funnier to have, in a comedy, someone who isn't doing something very well." And it's the birthday of the playwright John Guare, born New York City, 1938, author of Musica, Landscape of the Body, The House of Blue Leaves, and 6 Degrees of Separation. Here's a poem for today by W.S. Merwin, entitled simply, Sonnet. Where it begins will remain a question for the time being, at least, which is to say, for this lifetime. And there is no other life that can be this one again, and where it goes after that, only one at a time is ever about to know, though we have it by heart as one, and though we remind each other on occasion. How often may the clarinet rehearse alone the one solo before the one time that is heard after all the others, telling the one thing that they all tell of. It is the sole performance of a life. Come back, I say to it, over the waters. A poem by W.S. Merwin's Sonnet from his collection Migration, published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses improve their online reputation and reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. Produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
President Obama's administration is trying to work out its legal rationale for a controversial policy. It's the killing of American citizens suspected of terrorism. A newly obtained Justice Department document lays out a rationale. That document argues the United States has authority to target Americans who are senior al-Qaeda figures, even without evidence they are about to carry out a specific attack. NPR's Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson is here to talk about this document. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so administration officials have talked in speeches about transparency and the rule of law, but they haven't actually said what they mean or how that's supposed to work. What does this document add?
Steve, this document, which was obtained by NBC News' Michael Isikoff at NBC News last night, seems to add two important new details. One is, the government has said that it's going to have the power to target people who may be about to conduct an imminent attack. But now we know, as a result of this memo, that its definition of imminent is a little stretchy, like a rubber band, and that it does not, in its view, need intelligence indicating someone is about to carry out an attack right away in order to conduct a drone strike against them. Very, very controversial. The other thing that we've learned is that the government has always talked about the possibility of killing or capturing someone. And this memo seems to indicate that the government doesn't have to try all that hard to capture someone, so long as the capture poses an undue burden on the U.S., the U.S. doesn't have to go that route.
And we should mention, none of this legal reasoning is theoretical. There are actual cases in recent years where the United States States has launched drone strikes against American citizens abroad.
Yes, we know of one for certain, the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed in Yemen in September 2011. He was with a gentleman named Samir Khan, who was also a U.S. citizen, who died alongside al-Awlaki. And then a few weeks later, al-Awlaki's young son, teenage son, was also killed in Yemen. So we know of three Americans who have died at the end of drone strikes.
Okay, so this 16-page memo gives the Justice Department's legal rationale. It says, we don't have to have evidence of a specific strike that's about to happen. Being part of al-Qaeda, senior figure in al-Qaeda, is enough. What are civil rights groups saying about this? They've sued over the administration policy.
The ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights have both sued over the al-Awlaki and Khan attacks, and they've also tried to demand the government give out more information about these programs, which it's been very difficult to get for civil rights groups and members of Congress. The ACLU said last night this was disturbing and chilling. They're particularly offended that this memo indicates there's virtually no role for the U.S. court system, which they believe means there's virtually no oversight of these programs.
Why is this memo coming out now, Carrie Johnson?
We don't know for certain, Steve, but something else happened yesterday that's very interesting. 11 senators, both Democrats and Republicans, wrote to the president demanding that he turn over the still-secret OLC, Office of Legal Counsel, memos from the Justice Department in connection with the al-Awlaki attacks. And they indicated they could complicate the president's nomination to lead the CIA and the Pentagon. And then within a few hours, this NBC News story broke.
NPR's Carrie Johnson, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
She's our justice correspondent.
And a quick look at the local weather for Ketchikan and Metlakatla. Today, rain diminishing in the afternoon, highs 38 to 43, southeast wind 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy, chance of rain, lows around 33, southeast wind 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy, chance of rain, highs around 41, southeast wind 5 to 15, and tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, slight chance of rain, lows around 34, southeast wind 5 miles per hour. Thursday, mostly cloudy, slight chance of rain, highs around 41, northwest wind 5 miles per hour. Thursday night, cloudy, chance of snow and slight chance of rain, lows around 35. Friday through Saturday night, rain, highs around 42, lows around 37. And Sunday through Monday, rain likely, highs around 42, lows around 37. There's a special message some of you have may noticed as part of the Bawden Street Apartments demolition. The Bawden Street and Park Avenue intersection will be closed during working hours until further notice. One-way traffic will be opened up during non-working hours. Please watch for signs and workers in the area. Please contact BAM LLC at 907-254-2262 with any questions. That number again for BAM LLC is 254-2262. A look at the community calendar for today, Tuesday, February 5th. Rotary 2000 meets at noon at the Cape Fox. The Ketchikan Job Center offers an office skills boot camp from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. The Job Center is located at 2030 Sea Level Drive, Suite 220. The Takeoff Pound Sensibly Group meets at 5 p.m. in the hospital cafeteria. The group's mission is to support its members as they take off and keep off pounds sensibly. You can learn about volunteer opportunities with the Girl Scouts in a meeting beginning at 6:30 p.m. at the Ketchikan Public Library. And for tomorrow, Wednesday, February 6th, the Early Learning Program provides free hearing, vision, and developmental screenings for children under age 3 at the Public Health Center from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Call to schedule an appointment at 225-7825. Chamber lunch is at noon at the Cape Fox. The Department of Transportation is holding an open house from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Ted Ferry Civic Center. Input is sought on how to improve the busy portions of Mill, Front, and Stedman Streets between Deermont and Grant Streets. The main objective is to provide safe passage of pedestrians and vehicles. And today on the Ketchikan Gateway School District lunch menu, we have pepperoni pizza, romaine salad with ranch dressing, and kiwi. You've been listening to Morning Edition on KRBD Ketchikan. I'm Sean Carlson. Thanks for listening.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The White House says President Obama will ask Congress to identify spending cuts in the short term to delay across-the-board cuts from kicking in automatically March 1st. In a public statement scheduled this hour, the president will propose a budget package that would give Congress more time to reach a long-term agreement on reducing deficits. In another sign of housing recovery, the real estate data provider CoreLogic says home prices in December rose 8.3% from the year before, an annual jump not seen in 6.5 years. Most of the United States saw prices increase. Dell Computer is going private. NPR's Steve Henn reports the PC giant is bowing out of the stock market in a $24.4 billion buyout.
In what is by far the biggest private equity deal since the financial crisis, Silver Lake Partners, Microsoft, and Michael Dell have agreed to invest billions of dollars each to take control of Dell Computer. Michael Dell founded the company in 1984 in his college dorm room, and at one point, it was the largest computer manufacturer in the world. But Dell largely missed the mobile computing revolution, and although it's still profitable, its market share and revenue have been falling. The buyout offers current shareholders a 25% premium over what Dell's stock had been trading for last month, but it is still well below what the company was worth just a year ago. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Dell shares rose 11 cents to $13.38 per share in morning trading. At last check on Wall Street, Dow was up 108 at 13,988. NASDAQ up 34 at 3165. Bulgarian investigators have concluded that the militant wing of the Lebanese group Hezbollah is behind the July 18th attack that killed five Israelis, their Bulgarian driver, and a bomber. The government says a terrorist cell included Canadian and Australian citizens. The finding puts more pressure on the European Union to declare Hezbollah a terrorist organization. Days after last July's attack, Israel said it had intelligence connecting Hezbollah and Iran to the incident. Syrian rebels and Jordanian security have confirmed escalated fighting along the border with Jordan. 17 civilians were wounded. In Amman, Dale Gavlak reports the rebels say they're trying to take over government installations and border posts near Jordan.
Free Syrian Army spokesman Mohammed Itri called the fighting very decisive because it is the first time the rebels have tried to seize control of border posts and installations along Syria's southern frontier. The rebels already have taken over several border posts and other territory near Turkey. A Jordanian security official says the wounded included two Jordanians and 15 Syrian refugees, fleeing the military onslaught by President Bashar Assad's forces over the past 2 days. Jordan has bolstered its troops along the border to keep Syria's civil war from spilling over. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Amman.
Dow is up 110 points. This is NPR News.
Are you on a doubtful career path? The Southern Southeast Alaska Technical Education Center is offering the Safe and Competent Worker Series to begin on February 11th at the C-Tech building on 615 Stedman Street. This 7-week series includes multiple industry standard certificates such as first aid, CPR, AED, HAZWOPER, OSHA training, and more. To apply, stop by C-Tech or call Pete Jensen at 228-9294.
Hi, this is Bruce Wallace with the United Fishermen of Alaska. Did you know that conserving and restoring salmon habitat means jobs for Southeast Alaskans? Salmon already employ about 1 in 10 people here. Restoring salmon watersheds damaged in the past means more fish, bigger overall catches, and more jobs. With support from the Alaska Sustainable Salmon Fund, forest restoration projects are underway in the Tongass National Forest. Healthy forests mean healthy salmon, something we can all be proud of. This message was brought to you by the Alaska Sustainable Salmon Fund.
You can know the latest news the instant it happens.
Today's big story is always just a click away.
Yet that story leaves a few questions unanswered.
Like, what does it mean?
Is it really new?
How does it affect me?
Who are those people in the news?
And what about life in the rest of the world?
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Find answers to those questions and more when you wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition from 4 to 9 a.m. on KRBD Ketchikan.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You know the sensation of looking back at photos or videos of yourself over the years and seeing how you've changed? Imagine getting that kind of feeling by watching movies made over the years of people you don't know. The documentaries known as the Up series have that effect on many people. The series began in 1964 when Grenada TV in England broadcast the documentary film 7 Up about the lives of 14 children who were 7 years old and from diverse socioeconomic backgrounds. Every 7 years since then, filmmakers have returned to the people from the original film to document how their lives have changed. The new edition, the eighth in the series, is called 56 Up and catches up with its subjects at the age of 56. My guest Michael Apted was a researcher on 7-Up and has directed all the subsequent Up films. Apted is British and now lives in America. He's directed many fiction films, including Coal Miner's Daughter, Gorky Park, Gorillas in the Mist, and the James Bond film, The World Is Not Enough. Michael Apted, welcome and thank you for joining us. Let me go back to the very beginning. When 7-Up was first made, you were the researcher for the series. You weren't yet the director, which you became. So one of the things you had to do was choose the children. How did you go about choosing them?
Well, it was pretty arbitrary and very quick. It was part of a weekly series of programs, World in Action. I would ring the schools up. The schools, I'd say, would you help us make this film? And they would say yes or no. Then I'd go to the school and say to the teachers, teaching the seven-year-olds, bring me your brightest and your best. And I would look at them, talk to them, and then pick a couple. And the next thing that happened was, you know, there they were in front of the camera. So it was done in a very arbitrary way because we weren't interested in the personalities so much. We needed children who could, weren't fazed by us, who could speak to us, but we weren't looking for any particular characteristics. We were just interested in their backgrounds. The idea of the film was to examine the British class system in 1963-64 to see whether it was changing, seeing it was reflecting the great cultural upheavals that were going up in the United Kingdom from the Beatles onwards. So instead of getting professionals in to talk about it, the idea was that we would get some seven-year-old children from different backgrounds, from rich backgrounds, from poor backgrounds, from rural backgrounds like Nick Hitchin, from people who were removed from their parents, to get within about 14 children and have them talk about their lives, their ambitions, their dreams and whatever, and see whether that told us anything. And of course, it did, because it was both very funny and also chilling, showing that in fact the class system was very active and that people in certain backgrounds had a real vision of their future and others really didn't know what day it was. And so, you know, it made that point and the rest is history.
So this was supposed to be just a one shot. And then you stepped in and you wanted to make it, you wanted to do another one and eventually make it a series. Why did you want to do that?
Well, I wish what you said was true because then I could claim credit for it. But no, the film went out. It was a huge success. It was funny and chilling. And it took us 5 years before someone actually piped up and said, well, why don't we go back and see what happened to them? And we all thought, oh, that might be good. So we did go back. It wasn't a very interesting film because they were monosyllabic, spotty, and just general teenagers. But, you know, you could see the beginnings of a great idea that I don't think anybody had ever seen before. And so from then on, we all got behind it and we decided let's keep going back as long as we could and let this thing grow and see what happens to it.
So what was it like for you? What's it been like for you every 7 years to drop in on these people's lives and, you know, ask them about the landmark events that have happened in the seven-year interim?
What can I say? I mean, it's the favorite thing I've ever done, the thing I'm most proud of. It's nerve-wracking because you always think you're going to blow it and you'll wreck the whole thing. It seems fragile. And I've learned a lot of lessons about it. I've made mistakes on it and had to correct those mistakes. You know, particularly I got into a situation, I think, early on when I became judgmental about people, that if they didn't agree with my standards of success